us today. Yeah, so this morning what we're going to do, we're going to continue in our service. We're going to continue in our theme on the climb, the mountains of God. Now everyone else, they got to name their names or name their mountains, but mine's kind of set in stone, pardon the pun. We're going to talk about the Mount of Transfiguration this morning. So if you would turn to Mark chapter 9, verse 2 to 8, that would be great. Mark chapter 9, 2 to 8. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before him. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than any other in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Verse 6 says, he did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. So in order to get the fullness from a text, it's important to look at the context. It's important to look at the author themselves and what they've written. So it's widely agreed that this was written by Mark. It's kind of in the name. But it was written by John Mark. It's interesting about John, because John was he was young around the time of Jesus, so he would have known, he would have seen Jesus, but he wasn't old enough to have partaken in an active or a bigger part of the ministry. So he would have seen everything unfolding. John Mark was the assistant to three sort of biblical New Testament heavyweights, and Barnabas, who was his older cousin, Paul, and then Peter. But out of these three, it's undoubted that the person that he served and that had the greatest impact upon him was Mark, or was Peter, was Mark, that's himself. So how this book came about, how the Gospel of Mark came about was, it was found in an early church document and a record that in 66 AD to 70 AD, that the church in Rome wanted something more permanent from Peter. But the thing was, they were scared of Peter coming because of his reputation. He had the tendency of getting a little bit excited. And this was a real concern, because Nero at the time, he was in charge of Rome. So they more or less said, "We want your word, but don't you be coming, because you're going to get in trouble. So send it." So what actually happened was, Peter sat down with Mark, and Peter told Mark everything that he had seen, concerning the life of Jesus. And what we have now is, this is the manuscript, this is what was written. So this is the Gospel of Mark, this is how it came about. Now, the connection with Peter puts a bit more meat on the bones of our context. From looking at the other Gospels, we know a little bit about Peter. From looking at this Gospel especially, we know a lot about Peter. He's kind of like the itchy disciple. He can't sit still. He always has to be doing something. Whenever everyone else seems to be happy enough, Peter always has to be doing something. He's the itchy disciple. He's constantly on the move, and he has a zest for life. Whenever he's not jumping out of a boat, he's cutting off a servant's ear. He gets tired, and he doesn't want to wait on Jesus coming back, so he goes out fishing. I find him incredible. He's so funny, but we'll talk about that later. But Peter is a mover. He's excited. And this translates into how the Gospel of Mark reads. I can imagine, as Peter sits down and he hears everything he says everything to Mark, Mark's pen must be on fire, because he's excitable. And the Gospel of Mark reads like that. In fact, the Gospel of Mark is so high-paced and excited that an actor called Alex McCowan was able to hire out a theatre in London, in a big part of London, for months, because people were so excited to come and hear this Gospel. There's so much excitement and there's so much power in this Gospel that people literally queued to get tickets to come and hear this guy read this Gospel. It's an exciting one. So it's high-paced and it's filled with movement. However, this steam train of a Gospel, it has a purpose. He wasn't writing just for the sake of it. And his purpose is to show one thing, that Jesus is God's son. This is the overarching narrative over the whole of the gospel. Jesus is God's son. And before we get up to chapter 9, there's tiny glimpses, but we find in chapter 9 that this is cemented, that Jesus is God's son. Again, as we approach the cross, the high pace gospel begins to slow down until we come to a gradual halt in front of the cross. And like I say, it's at the Mount of Transfiguration that the first notable reduction in pace is exposed as we see Jesus' identity as God's own son. So let's move on. True to Mark's style, the disciples are on the move. So we read in verse 2 that there's already a bit of a drumming up of excitement. Things are getting a little bit pacey again. I mean, anyone familiar with Old Testament scriptures would know that on or around mountains, if something's happening, it's going to be big. Exciting things happen around mountains. And hopefully over the course of this month, you're beginning to see that exciting things happen around mountains. As well as this, there would have been around with the three. So we have the mountain itself. The mountain itself is actually Mount Hermon. So flick back a wee bit there, please. Perfect. So the mount here is Mount Hermon. That's it up there, top corner. And Mount Hermon is actually snowy. I found that really interesting. The top of Mount Hermon, it's covered in snow. And from here to Jerusalem, so Jerusalem would just be about here. I'll have to jump. There, so there's Jerusalem. And so from Mount Hermon, the top of Mount Hermon, all the way down to Jerusalem, it's a downhill slope. It's all the way down there. As I said, there's snow at the top of Mount Hermon, and it's this snow that whenever it melts, it runs through and down through all sort of crevices and stuff, and it becomes the source of the River Jordan. So it's an important mountain. And today, fun fact, there's a ski resort on Mount Hermon. So if you want to go and ski on Mount Hermon, work away. So there we have the mountain itself, but we also have the company. According to the law, the Old Testament law, in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 6, at least two or three witnesses had to be present in order for something to be held as truth. So if there's more than two or three people, truth is going to be exposed. It's a bit of an insight. So Jesus, he says to his three beloved disciples, come on, we're going up a mountain. So here we have the mountain, we have the company, and finally we have the timing as well. We read that six days after, they begin to go up the mountain. Luke records as 8, so it's very possible it was actually 7. So it was just in between those two, 7 being the number of perfection in the Bible. So we have the timing, we have the location, and we have the company. So this is going to be a big event. Mark is pointing to something that is going to be massive. Now we see the glory. In verse 2, there's just this tiny little statement, but it's packed with glory. It just says, and he was transfigured before them. Like I say, it's a big statement. And we could dive into a commentary or we could see what another deep-thinking theologian is going on. But I think in Scripture, we actually get a fuller picture of what this looks like, the transfiguration, of what is momentarily revealed to the disciples. In fact, we can boil down what is happening into a single sentence. The glory of Christ is being revealed. Now, it's impossible to describe properly what they're seeing, but I think we get a fuller picture when we look to Revelation. So if you just want to flick to Revelation chapter 1, verse 12 to 20. So Revelation chapter 1, verse 12 to 20. And this is John writing this. So John, the beloved, who was here on the mountain, he's writing this. This was a vision that was given to him whenever he was exiled to the island of Patmos. And it says, verse 12, I turned round to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned round, I saw 7 golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like the Son of Man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet, with a golden sash around his chest. The hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow. And his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in the furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held 7 stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun, shining in all of its brilliance. When I saw him, I fell to my feet as though dead. And he placed his right hand on me and said, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, but now look, I am alive forever and ever. And I hold the keys of death and Hades. Write therefore what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels and the seven are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. This is a picture of the risen Christ. So this book, Revelation, was written to seven churches. So this is Jesus in the midst of his church. This is what the risen Christ looks like. This is the Christ that we pray to. This is the Christ that we worship. This is what he looks like. And there's some ambiguous terms there, but hopefully you're beginning to get a weight of the glory that is being revealed. But it gets better. Go to Revelation 5. Revelation 5, verse 11 to 13. I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands, and 10,000s times 10,000s. They encircled the throne of the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they were saying, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and glory and honor and praise. I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all of them in this saying, to him who sits on the throne, to the Lamb, be praise, honor, and glory and power forever and ever. Again, this is the Christ that we worship, and we've just sang it. Praise, honor, and glory to him who is on the throne. He is at the center of everything that is going on here. But it gets better. Revelation chapter 21, verse 22 to 27. And this addresses the idea of God's light. So Revelation chapter 21, 22 to 27, again concerning Jesus. It says, I did not see a temple in the city because the Lord Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city does not need sun or the moon to shine on it. For the glory of God gives light and the Lamb is its lamp. The nation will walk by the light and the kings of earth will bring their splendor into it. And on no day will the gates ever be shut. For there will be no night. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does anything that is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Like, when I read that, I get excited. The reason I get excited is because it's not just a story. That's my future. That's your future. Whenever we read that, that is literally what we are going to see. Whenever we see Christ in his fullness, that is what we are going to see. I love that. That's incredible. It gets me excited inside. And again, as we were speaking, as we were worshiping earlier, like, that's not even a shadow on what this is going to be like. And like, I love here. I love this church. Like, it's amazing, but heaven's going to be so much better. Like, I can't wait. It's going to be amazing. But that is a reality. Today, our light comes from the sun, but one day our light will come from the sun. G.K. Chesterton says, it's a shame that Revelation is passed off to the theologians and the scholars because it, more than any other book, cements the assurance of heaven in us. Whenever I read that, I just get excited for heaven because that's a reality. And in the light of that, things go strangely dim. In the light of that. His glory is such that he lights the earth. And here in Mark chapter 9, we see a glimpse of that. The veil of Jesus' humanity is dropped momentarily, and his eternal glory shines through. And in an instant, everything is changed. I'm sure it could have been possible that as the three disciples are walking up this snowy hill, it would have been hard work. Has anyone ever walked up like Donard whenever it's slightly frosty? It's really annoying because every step just seems to take that much more. It just seems to get harder. And I'm sure the disciples may have been turning around and they might have been feeling tired. They might have been saying, why has Jesus decided to walk up a mountain with us, up this snowy mountain? They might have been discontent. They might have been hungry. There might have been different things going on. But in the light of Christ's glory, it all melts away. All the problems that they had, everything that was going on, in the light of Christ's true glory, it all just fades away. And just to reiterate what's been said in previous weeks by Ali and Bill as well, Just as in the midst of Christ's glory, the disciples' problems melt away, if you take time to look at Jesus, your problems will melt away in the light of his glory. And whenever you look at your inheritance, the thing that is ahead, things get a little bit better. Not just a little bit better, but they get a lot bit better. Psalm chapter 30, verse 5 says, "Weeping may last through the night, but joy comes in the morning." Your problems are temporary. God's glory is eternal. Your problems are temporary, but God's glory is eternal. There may be weeping now, but I can guarantee you, whether in this life, but certainly in the next, joy is coming. There's going to be a morning and there isn't going to be a night. His glory is such that there is no night. Again, I'm excited for that. I can't wait. The hymn says, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look in his wonderful face, and the things of this earth will go strangely dim in the light of his glory and of his grace." Sometimes we just need to look at Jesus. Sometimes we just need to spend time in his presence, and we'll develop an eternal perspective. So we move on. Mark's description of Jesus's clothes in verse 3 says that, "And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could ever bleach them." His clothes became intensely white as no one on earth could ever bleach them. Whenever I read that, I thought it was a wee bit strange. Why was that the first thing that you go for, is bleaching your clothes? But the more that I thought about it, the more I realized that if we look around today, we can see hundreds and thousands of people who are trying to bleach their own clothes to reach Christ's standard. Certainly, if you look at other religions, that's what becomes apparent. In Islam, Allah is a strict judge that will only be merciful to you if you have lived a life filled with good works and religious devotion. In Hinduism, one must devote themselves to a god or a goddess of their choice and serve them according to their specifications. Depending on how someone does, they will be reincarnated as hopefully as something better. In Mormonism, only good works prescribed by Joseph Smith will get you into heaven. According to Jehovah's Witnesses, only 144,000 people will get into heaven, and this will be determined by good works. On Mount Hermon itself, there are 30 different shrines to the Roman gods. So it's very possible, in fact, it is possible, that whenever Jesus was there, there were shrines around him as the sun was exposed as the true Son of God. The Roman gods themselves were not to be they weren't to be involved with. If a Roman god was in any way, in Roman culture, if a god was interested in you, it meant something bad was coming your way. They were to be appeased and never loved. They were malevolent and only interacted with humans to cause hurt or bring misfortune their way. And only acts of sacrifice would get them to leave you alone. There seems to be a common spine that runs through the majority of the world's religions. Since the first false gods right up until now, it's always been about good works and distant deities. And to a certain extent, that makes sense. Because humans can only think in a human capacity. Because evil, we see, needs to be overturned by good. So humans realize that there's something bigger than themselves and they have to work their way towards it. Hence, they create their own religions to try and appease their own morality or the things that are within. This is how I know Christianity is right. This is how I know that Jesus is true, because only God would have the audacity to say, "Do you know what? I'm coming down there for you. It's nothing about what you do." He looks down on our helpless estate and he sends his own son to the earth. Rather than the created reaching up, God reaches down. No other religion will you find that, because every other religion is determined upon how you act. But ours is determined upon how God has acted, how God has sent the Son for us. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 20 and 21 says, "Therefore we are ambassadors for Christ. God making his appeal through us, we implore you on behalf of Christ to be reconciled to God. For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, that we in him might become the righteousness of God." that we in him might become the righteousness of God. C.S. Lewis said, the Son of Man became man to enable all sons to become sons of God. The Son of God became a man to enable men to become sons of God. Stop trying to bleach your own clothes. If you're a Christian today, stop trying to bleach your own clothes. You will never, ever be able to bleach them as white as Christ's. When God sees you, he sees the very righteousness of Christ. To cling to your good works is to adopt the mindset of every other religion. We have been shown a better way, therefore we must live in it. We can't cling to our own good works. That's how the other ones think. We know a better way, and we need to live in it. We need to realize that it's not about us. Our righteousness is determined by Christ. Again, isn't that incredible? Our righteousness is determined by Christ himself, God's own son. So we move on again. And in the midst of everything that is going on, in the midst of the incredible things that are going on, I've written it up there, Peter does a Peter. In verse chapter 5, Peter blurts out, Rabbi, it is good for us that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. I love this statement, for he didn't know what to say, so they were terrified. Peter didn't know what to say, so he just said something anyway. I know so many, I'm like that as well. Do you ever get that? Something so awkward, you don't know what to do, so you just blurt it out there. Remember what we talked about earlier in terms of Peter having a massive hand in the Gospel of Mark? It's possible that he could have left this out. If he was talking to Mark, he could have just bypassed that. He could have papered over the cracks, because if you didn't read the other Gospels, then you wouldn't really know that that happened. But he does. He leaves it in. In his own testimony, he makes a point of showing his own failure. Why does he do it? I believe that Peter is trying to cement a culture of me too in the church at Rome and the wider church. A culture of me too. I think he realizes the value that is found in exposing one's own previous failures in order to encourage the church and say me too. When I read Mark, I don't know about you, sometimes I get encouraged by how Peter acts. I look at my own failures in the past and the not so distant past either, where I acted quickly, where I did something stupid, where I wasn't thinking, where I acted out of jealousy, just whatever has gone on. And the thing is, people can sometimes learn more from your failures than from your victories if you're prepared to share them. Something powerful happens when another believer, maybe older, maybe more mature, or perhaps even a peer, puts their arm around you in a moment of vulnerableness, not a word, in the moment of being vulnerable, and says, me too. Something powerful happens whenever someone puts their arm around you in a moment of being vulnerable and says, me too. In Impact, it's our youth club there, we've launched a theme, and it's called I Wish You'd Have Told Me. And every week, one of our leaders comes up and shares something from their walk, something that they wish they had been told whenever they were their age. And we've only done one so far, but it was amazing. This week, on Friday night there, Jamie Hawthorne was up and he was speaking just about his past and the things that had gone on. And he just laid down a me too in front of all those kids. In fact, he came up and said, can I be honest here? Do you allow me to be honest? Yes, everything changed. The momentum of the room completely changed because they were hearing authenticity. They were hearing honesty. He laid down a me too, but the follow-up was, but there's hope. And this is the key to what Peter's trying to get across. Me too, but there's hope. In churches, sometimes we can, on the wider scale, we can put on a mask of perfection. And whenever we wear it, certainly in Northern Irish culture, as I say, this seems to be the norm. We can apply the mask over our face, and it sort of papers over the cracks of what is currently going on in our lives. We walk into church, and someone always asks us, it's a Northern Irish thing to do, someone asks you, how are you? I'm all right, I'm doing okay. That's what you do. We go to the textbook Northern Irish answer of, I'm all right. I'm good. It's going okay. It's fine. But if something is actually wrong, that's like running into a doctor's surgery, him asking what's wrong and you going, nah, never mind, and limping out. You're in a place of healing. Why rob yourself of it? And whenever you're talking to anyone, whether that be in church or at home or anywhere, you're constantly on the cusp of healing, on the cusp of whatever is going on, someone praying through that with you. I think the beauty of this church is that people genuinely care. I look around, I love coming to this church in the morning, and Sunday morning, Sunday night, because I know that people care. There's a real authenticity. Perhaps the person that you choose to be vulnerable with has gone through exactly the same thing that you have. And they can throw their arm around you and say, me too, but there's hope. And if not, then you have the opportunity of someone to pray and intercede for you. It's a win-win, really. Being vulnerable is a win-win because we as Christians are a body, and if one part of the body is slightly hurt, we don't cut it off. We pray for it. We try and heal it. That's what we do. That's what we were created to do. Don't rob yourself of the opportunity of healing by being quiet. Don't rob yourself of the opportunity by running out of the doctor's surgery. If you're hurting, say something. I believe that we have to be vulnerable with each other just as Peter is vulnerable with us. It's a standard that's set there. It's often said that hurt people hurt people, but what if healed people heal people? What if we could proclaim, as Joseph does in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, as for you, you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good, to bring about that which many people should be kept alive as they are today. As for you, you meant for evil against me, but God meant it for good. It could be that your past experiences could lead to another person's breakthrough. It could be that your past experiences, the things that you thought were evil, the things that you thought you're just going to sweep under the carpet, could be that that provides the key to someone's breakthrough. Me too, but there's hope. We move on again. I was away over the week there at a Serious for God thing over in Malvern. It was lovely. Really liked it. In a big mountain, so it inspired me for today. And the speaker was a fellow called Mike Pilavachi. For those who don't know him, according to Wikipedia, the Reverend Mike Pilavachi is a British charismatic Christian evangelist The Reverend Mike Pilavachi is a British charismatic Christian evangelist and author of Greek Cypriot descent. He is a co-founder and leader of Soul Survivor Charity based in Watford, United Kingdom. He also has an album called Pilavachi Sings Christmas. There you go, there's a plug. So you can buy yourself Pilavachi Brings Christmas, Sings Christmas. And midway through one of his talks, he was doing it was sort of a seminar thing. And in the middle of his talks, he dropped just a wee nugget and moved on very quickly. And no one else seemed to pick up on it, but I loved it. And I thought, I'm definitely going to be sharing that this morning. What he said was, revelation happens in the context of friendship. Revelation happens in the context of friendship. He went on to say that God shouts at his enemies, but he whispers to his friends. I love that. God shouts at his enemies, but he whispers to his friends. I thought it was beautiful. Because whenever we marry this picture of the risen Christ, the glory of the risen Christ, with someone that wants to share a relationship with us, someone who wants to be our friend, someone who calls us friend, we get a wonderful picture of how God speaks to us and reveals his character to us. I think in our own passage, there's a picture of what's happening there. Jesus has taken his three closest friends and has walked up a mountain. The entire journey takes place in the context of friendship. Why are we going up this mountain? I trust you. We're going up as friends. We get to the top and then bam. Suddenly the revelation of Jesus is shown. Remember that line, Revelation 1 verse 17. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. That's John that was writing that. So John would have known, John would have seen Christ. He would have known these things. He bore witness to this transfiguration. But seeing the light of the risen Christ, he falls as though he is dead. But then there's something that interesting that happens. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, "Do not be afraid." Again, this is John that is writing this. This is John, the beloved one. At the Last Supper, we see that he's leaning on Christ's chest. As the other disciples say, "You have the Lord's ear." He was that close to him. Yet whenever he sees the risen Christ, he falls down as dead. But then that line comes, "Then he placed his right hand on me." I wonder, did he recognize the hand? I wonder, did whenever he felt that hand, he recognized it, he realized that this is Christ. I wonder, was that whole scenario in Revelation, was it revealed in the context of friendship? I don't think he was afraid anymore because he recognized who it was. Before it says it was someone who was like the Son of Man, but I'm almost sure that he knew straight away whenever he felt this hand, that familiar hand of Jesus, that it was his friend. Revelation happens in the context of friendship. Do we need to change how we approach Christ? Sometimes it's easy for us to see him as those other religions see him, as a distant God, as a powerful God, but a distant one. He wants to have a friendship, a relationship with you. Sometimes we just need to embrace that. Sometimes we just need to realize that he is our friend and allow revelation to be shown in the context of friendship. At the end of the transfiguration narrative, it's sort of different because a lot of people focus on what happens at the top of the mountain. But the group begin their descent down the mountain. And I can imagine the three are brimming with excitement. They're ready to tell the others of what they have seen. Like, can you imagine that this is Jesus that you've been walking with and you always were, you were nearly sure that he was the Son of God, but then it was confirmed by God who spoke from a cloud. "This is my son." They were excited. But Jesus turns to them and says, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen." They reach the bottom of Mount Hermon. And there's a large crowd that is gathered. It's the disciples and the scribes. And they're arguing about their inability to cast out a spirit from a boy. The spirit makes the boy mute. And not only this, but it throws him to the ground. It makes him foam. He grinds his teeth and he becomes rigid. This boy is in a bad way whenever they come down the mountain. From the top of the mountain, basking in the presence of Jesus, hearing the very voice of God, saying, "This is my beloved son, listen to him," to this. Talk about a reality check. Sometimes I think that's what Monday morning feels like. We go to church and we seem to get filled and we seem to get excited. We seem to have a tangible presence of God. And then we walk into school, then we walk into work or wherever it may be, and there seems to be a reality check. This is me when I was wee. Amazing. When I was younger, I loved two things, blue ice cream and my dad. So there's me with blue ice cream. Dad's not there. And like most wee fellas, I thought my dad was the dad. When I was walking up the street with my dad, I felt like we could do anything. Whenever he was holding my hand, I felt as though I could do anything. However, the thing that seemed to... It seemed to resonate with me most in the context of my dad being able to do anything was fighting. I don't know where it came from. Dad never had anyone in front of me. So I don't know where it came from. But I thought my dad could take on anyone. The problem is, as a child, I was very, very vocal. And there was one day that we were waiting in the queue of a bank. And there was this absolute mountain of a man. Dad tells me, I don't remember it, but apparently it's burnt into his... I don't fear. So I saw this massive man, this hulk of a man, and my dad's not that tall. He's shorter than me, imagine. Thanks for those jeans, Dad. But so we're waiting in the queue, and there's this massive man. And Dad said he was like tricked out in leather, real scary looking fella. And Dad looked at me, and he saw my eyes light up. Now, we're in the queue for a bank, which doesn't really move that quickly. He just saw my eyes light up and my hand go raised to this man. And as loud as I could, I just shouted, "Dad, I bet you could beat him in a fight." "Shut up, son, stop talking." The thing is, because we were in the bank queue, I kept on going. Like, no matter how much my dad was like, "James, please stop talking. Shush, no, child." It didn't work. I was convinced that my dad could have this guy in a fight, no sweat. Again, not that he was like a violent human being or anything. I thought my dad was capable of anything. If he told me that he could fly, I'd be dragging him up to the top of a building and saying, "Right, let's go." In fact, now, it's sort of weird now, even I'm in like my 20s and he's 52 and he's still like outpacing people as we play football. He's a freak of nature, the man. But I still have that sense of awe with my dad. I think whenever you get older, you go through that weird teenage period where you think they're idiots, and then you get to your 20s and you're like, they're geniuses. Amen. First amen, amazing. But I thought my dad could do absolutely anything. Whenever Peter moves on, he loves the mountaintop experience. Whenever Peter's up there, in fact, he loves it so much that he says, can we put a tent down here? Can we make this permanent? But the truth, I think there's a truth here, and that the pace of Mark highlights. Mountaintop experiences were meant for valleys. Let me qualify that. We can be like Peter and wish that our moments of closeness and wonder with God stay in high places. These moments that we share happen in church, they happen at home, in the quiet place. We wish they would go on forever, but that's never where they were intended to stay. William MacDonald writes in his commentary, "The disciples were not permitted to remain at the mountaintop of glory. In the valley below was a groaning and sobbing mankind, a world that was in the need of Jesus, a world that needed Jesus to lay at the foot of the mountain. In the valley below, people needed Jesus." On the 21st, or on the 29th of January 2001, U2 released a song called "Stuck in a Moment." And the words say, "You've got to get yourself together. You've got stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it." And I think this can be true for our Christian walks. We may have had mountaintop experiences, and we've longed to get back to it, to live in it, to make it permanent in our lives. However, we need to realize that mountaintop experiences strengthen us to walk boldly into the valley. That's why they're there. We are built up so that we can walk into the valley. Just like my dad, the disciples had seen something that had catalyzed their ministry. They had seen their Father shine. They had seen Jesus, the Son of Man. They had seen his glory, and this was catalyzing them to go on. Just like with my dad, I thought anything was possible. And I'm sure as they walked down the mountain, they were sure that anything was possible because they'd literally just seen him in the middle of Moses and Elijah, and a cloud came that was God and said, "This is my son." It catalyzed their ministry. But the reality of it is that while this was going on at the top of the mountain, that little boy was probably convulsing and foaming. His father's heart was broken. While this was going on at the top of the mountain, this discussion and Peter saying, "Get the tent," and Jesus' glory shining, while that was happening at the top of the mountain, this little boy was in trouble and his dad's heart was broken. And the reality of it is, as we are here worshiping, there are people in the valley outside these doors that are hurting. That's the reality of what's going on. We can pretend as though they don't exist, but they absolutely do. There are people hurting outside. Who are we to withhold the hope and glory of Jesus Christ from them? That's not our job. We are sent to bring Christ into the valley. The disciples walked down with Christ, and Christ was able to heal that boy. Whenever we go into our workplaces, whenever we go into our school, whenever we go into our street or anything like that, there, we bring Christ to bring hope and healing to a hurting valley. He comes down the mountain with us. Jesus' life was never lived for himself. Likewise, our Christian lives are not lived for ourselves. The best thing that you can do for others is read your Bible and pray. The best thing that you can do for others is read your Bible and pray. Have you ever noticed that nothing grows on top of a mountain? If you go to the top of Slieve Donard or anything else, there's very little vegetation at the top. And remember what we talked about earlier? This mountain was the source of the River Jordan. The mountaintop was the source of growth in the valley. We have to realize that these mountaintop experiences equip us for growth in the valley. We have to take what we're getting here. We have to take what we're getting in our own quiet times, in our own discussions and small groups, and we have to take them into the valley, because nothing is going to grow at the top of the mountain. The growth happens in the valley. Therefore, we need to be in the valley with the necessary nutrients to grow things. That is Christ. So the bottom line is we need Jesus. In every single point, we need Jesus. Because without Jesus, we stagger up a mountain alone. Without Jesus, we are hopelessly bleaching our own clothes with good intentions and empty works. Without Jesus, there is no relationship. Without Jesus, we cannot make a difference in the valley. Bottom line, we need Jesus. That's what the transfiguration tells me. And there's a lot to process there. But perhaps there's something that you're thinking about, or something that has sort of struck a chord, or something that you need to think about further, because there were four different points. Perhaps you need to realize that you're not walking up this mountain alone. Perhaps you need to realize that you can be vulnerable. Perhaps you can realize that your righteousness doesn't come from yourself, it comes from God. But we should all be preparing ourselves to walk into the valley tomorrow morning, because that's the reality of a person who lives for Christ. They bring Christ wherever they go. I'm gonna play a video now. It's just a worship song. It's by Elevation Worship, and it's called "O Come to the Altar." And sometimes I think whenever I'm in church, things happen very quickly, and suddenly I'm home. But I just want you to go back to the Revelation passage and just dwell on the risen Christ. Whenever it's on, perhaps you need to pray some things through. Perhaps you need to give something over. I don't know what's going on in your head, but this is your space.